This is recorded on the morning of May the 16th, 1972, in the offices of President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde at Purdue University. This recording is made for the Purdue University Archives. This is recorded on the morning of May the 16th, 1972, in the offices of President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde of Purdue University. This recording and other tapes in this series are to be deposited in the Purdue University Archives and to be used by all properly accredited purposes. Well, I presume the best thing, Mr. Hovde, is to start out and with the beginning. Would you tell us something about where you were born, your early boyhood, and something about your family?
Thank you, Bob. It's an old saying, of course, that no man can choose his parents or his place of birth. And happenstance had it that I happened to be born in Erie, Pennsylvania. My father was a civil servant, a meteorologist, and worked his entire working career until his retirement with the United States Weather Bureau. And in the early years of his service, he was transferred several times and was working in the Weather Bureau office in Erie, Pennsylvania. When I came along, I have no memory of Erie. My earliest...
By the way, what date?
February 7, 1908. I have no memories of Erie. And the first memories that remain in mind when I was a baby were visiting my father's office in Nashville, Tennessee, from which office there was a view of the Cumberland River, I believe.
And State House?
I don't remember the buildings. I simply remember, vaguely remember, as perhaps a two-year-old visiting my father's office in Nashville, Tennessee. But when I was 5 years old, the family moved to Devil's Lake, North Dakota. My father was assigned there as the U.S. weather observer, meteorologist. Devil's Lake, North Dakota, at that time, about 1913, prior to World War I, was a city of approximately 5,000 people, located 100 miles west of the Red River Valley, the eastern border of North Dakota, 60 miles south of the Canadian border. And the city is originally located on the northern arm of what was then, certainly from the stories told about it, must have been one of the most beautiful inland lakes in the United States, called Devil's Lake, or as the Indians called it, Minnewaukon, or Spirit Water, so my memory serves me correctly. The usual Indian story of the storm on the lake and the Indian princess and her suitor being drowned and so on. But at any rate, the area around Devil's Lake was hilly and heavily wooded and was, before the white man, one of the great happy hunting grounds of the Sioux Indians of that territory. And to the south of Devil's Lake, in those wooded hills, was located one of the U.S. Army forts, Fort Totten. And when I was a boy growing up there, Fort Totten Indian Reservation was to the south, on the south side of this great and beautiful lake. The lake was fed by it was called a coulee, almost a river, which drained all the land to the north up to the Canadian borders down into Devil's Lake. As that country was opened by the homesteaders and farmed, the drainage into the lake was cut off, and the lake began to dry up. And when I was a boy, the lake was dried up 5 miles from the city's edge, whereas in 1880, when the city, the railroad came through, you could step off the railroad at the station and walk down to the water's edge.
Well, it must have been, however, a very nice country to play in for a boy growing up.
Well, it was a fascinating country in many ways, and in retrospect, I was lucky in my parents, and I was lucky in where we lived when I was a youth. At any rate, the people of this area, of course, were the city was the trading center for a large area, both east and west, and to the north and to the south.
Was it farming?
And this was all farming, wheat farming, oats. Mainly the summer wheat, the hard wheats. The winters were long and cold. It was prairie land to the north and to the west. And the winds blew across the Dakota plains. But and the summers could be hot. And the winters cold, but
the wind never stopped.
The wind always blew. But the people were hardy. Great many Norwegians and people of Norwegian and Swedish descent who had homesteaded in that area. And school system was well managed.
Did you go to elementary school in Devil's Lake throughout?
We moved there when I was 5, and the U.S. Weather Bureau was a big two-story red brick square house, flat-topped roof with a railing around it, and on top of the roof was the tall steel tower with the wind vane and anemometer, which were recorded continuously in my father's office, which was also in this house. This house had a lawn, well, covered three-quarters of a block, and to the north had a lawn a block long and a half a block wide, a great winding driveway which came up beside the house. Lots of nice trees had been planted and were growing. Two other families lived in this block. One family, the Kellys. The youngest son of that family was my age. The older brothers gave the two of us a rough time. There were 5 Kelly brothers. The well-to-do Catholic family, in fact, Colonel Kelly, the father, had built the railroad north from the Great Northern up from Devil's Lake to Manitoba, up to Manitoba. Brandon, Manitoba, I believe, called the Farmers Grain and Shipping Company. This great house of ours, where we lived, was situated right across the street from the big three-story building which housed the primary grades and the junior high school, and behind it the high school. So from my back door in the morning, It was a sprint across the street to the door of the school. And on the other side, to the south of the school, was the Carnegie Public Library, less than a block away. So I grew up in this house with my own football field as a lawn, and schools, grade school and high school, across the street, and the library, a block away.
Did you graduate from high school there?
Yes, I finished grade school, sixth grades, and then the junior high school, the seventh and eighth grade, and then the four grades in Devil's Lake High School.
Played football in high school?
Having the principal play area in my neighborhood there, it was a natural center for all the kids in the surrounding few blocks that were my neighbors and friends. And having a football field and a football, I had my own team. I was captain and coach and quarterback and ran the whole show. By the time I could walk, practically. And
I'm curious.
My team was never defeated. We used to play our games with the kids from the south side of town and the west side of town on Saturday mornings. And it was great fun to manage and coach the team, even as a kid, kids my own age.
Did you practice drop kicking?
Oh,
so,
yeah,
did
we
ever
punted,
break any windows?
We punted and drop kicked and we broke windows and all that sort of thing. Dad was a very gentle and wise man. And he never objected to our using this lawn. Of course, one of the prices that you had to pay was that you had to keep it mowed. And it was an awfully big lawn to be
with a hand mower.
Mowed with the hand mowers of those days.
Yeah. What kind of teaching did you get in high school as you look back on it?
Well, we go back to the athletics before we come to the teaching.
Good.
You naturally play the games for the season, and in the fall you played football, and in the winter basketball, and in the spring track. And I enjoyed participation in these three sports. And in a small town, the opportunity was there. And high school had good organization, good coaches. My senior year, my class had 40 students in it. Senior class that I graduated it with in 1925 had 40 students, 18 boys and 22 girls. We had an undefeated football team that fall, my senior year. We won the state championship in basketball. And three of us on the track team placed third in the state track meet. We were really the best football team in the state that fall, too. But in the knockout final game, two of our players received broken bones in a very vicious high school game with Minot, North Dakota. And we were so crippled we couldn't play in the final game. We'd beaten Minot 25-0 earlier in the season, but in the playoff we played at Minot and they tied us 3-3, but we were so crippled. We had practically just enough boys to make a football team, and we couldn't play in Minot. Represented, played in the finals that year because we declined. We were unable to play. So it was an unusual high school experience. After we won the state championship in basketball, town raised enough money to send us to the National High School Tournament in Chicago at the University of Chicago. And that trip to the National Tournament is one of the highlights of my high school life. Go to see the big city for the first time. My first visit to the Field Museum, which I shall never forget. And to play in that tournament at the University of Chicago against a team from Beaumont, Texas, which we defeated, and a team from Durham, North Carolina, which beat us. It was lots of fun. The teaching experience, teaching was uniformly good throughout the whole system, in my memory. I had good teachers in the grade schools. But being a boy who liked to read, liked to study, liked to excel in the classroom, I enjoyed it, and this is true of most people who excel in the classroom. They enjoy it.
You had nothing at home to deter you from reading, and probably
no.
You said you were
Dad,
encouraged.
Dad was a meteorologist, and as such was a man interested in natural phenomena. The weather, of course, was his work, but he was interested in the wildlife. He was interested in natural phenomena of all kinds.
Did you take
this? And his office was filled with the instruments, the triple register, which kept the continuous records and the barometer and the weather, the little tower out in the backyard where he did his observations, humidity and temperature. Maximum and minimum, and all these were recorded by hand in records. Dad's records were the most beautiful examples of handwriting and record keeping of numbers. Were absolutely models of calligraphic beauty and accuracy. He had a great pride in the accuracy of his records. And I think he went years without making an error. And to do the averages of the temperature averages and the averages of the other numbers, he had to add and then divide and so on, do this. And as I remember, like, as a child watching him, he could add a column of figures just sort of looking down the figures and add it. He had a lot of influence on the other kids. Across the street lived a Jewish family, the Sprungs. Older son, Murray Sprung. They were, in those days, a well-to-do family. Mr. Sprung ran the furniture store in town. Murray Sprung, my father interested that boy in science, and he later became a PhD from Princeton in chemistry. Kitty corner from us in a little yellow house that was barely better than a shack lived another family, one of the poorest families in town. Eddie Spring was about the same age as Murray Sprung. Sprung and Spring, it's a funny combination. Eddie Spring later became interested in science, went on to the university, took a PhD in physics, and for many years was professor of theoretical physics at the University of Minnesota. Dad interested those boys in science.
And of course he interested you.
And he interested me too. He had a library, of course. And he was a self-educated man. He graduated from South High School in Minneapolis. Should have gone on to the university, but had no money and took the exam, civil service exams, and started out with the Weather Bureau. He was one of the few men I know who read every volume of Dr. Elliott's 5-foot shelf. I had a brother and two sisters. I was the older of the children. My brother was 2 years younger. My older sister was 2 years younger than my brother. And there was 4 years between my two sisters. We were a card-playing family, too. Dad and mother liked to play cards. So we were all taught to play cards when we were young.
You think this attributes your love of poker?
Well, poker is one thing.
Card playing is another one.
Best card game, of course, is contract bridge. By far the best game. Poker's fun, but all card games are fun, but at least they're fun to one who likes to play cards. But that's where it started, on the card game. Mother and Dad played Norwegian whist, which was the forerunner of bridge. They used to play, well, it was Norwegian whist, and then they played auction bridge. And then Vanderbilt in the 20s invented contract bridge, and then they tried to play contract bridge. Dad was active and knew everybody in the city, of course, because of his work. And he was a very friendly man who liked people. People liked him. In those days, the social life of the city was bound up in large part with the lodges. The lodges were very important. Masonic Lodge, the Knights of Columbus, the Oddfellows, the Woodmen, the Elks. Days before, and TV and radio were just coming in the early 20s. Movies were one of the great entertainments of that day. And when I was in high school, a neighbor friend of mine ran the motion picture machines in the Bijou Theater, and I used to go down and help him run the motion picture machines, switch from one machine to another when the reels changed, wound the reels and patched the film. And in those 20s, early 20s, saw all the Charlie Chaplin movies and the Laurel and Hardy, Mack Sennett comedies, the great serials with Pearl White and The Black Secret, and The Perils of Thunder Mountain, and Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks and William S. Hart and all the...
Tom Mix
and all the early stars before the talkies came in. So I had an early introduction into the movies.
You remember,
how
the town took World War I at all?
Oh yes, World War I was an interesting time for me because I sold papers. I used to go down to the train and get the Grand Forks paper. Grand Forks was a town 100 miles to the east, a larger city than Delaware. And in the late afternoon, the train came through with the papers, and I would get my papers every afternoon. And of course, during World War I, 1917 in particular, I was then, 9 years old? And I used to have a root around through the business section and hawk my papers, and whenever there was an extra, of course, where they sold like hotcakes. There was no World War I, as I remember it, in that particular community. There wasn't any anti-war sentiment. There was great many of the older fellows around town, of course, went off to the wars.
Was there any anti-German sentiment?
A little bit, but not enough to affect me because I was only 8 or 9 years old.
But the community was not hostile as it was in some places.
There were not very many Germans in the community. Scandinavians, mostly. And, I suppose half the people were Scandinavian descent, and not very many Germans emigrated to that. German emigration had preceded the Scandinavian emigration. And Wisconsin, of course, got large numbers of Germans.
In my native state, Nebraska, got a lot. Yes. I grew up in a community half descended from Civil War veterans and half German, you see.
That's why the social life of the town also involved the Chautauqua program. Down on Devil's Lake in a lovely, beautiful wooded section, about 5 miles away from town, served incidentally by a little trolley line. You could take the Turnerville trolley from town down to Chautauqua, as it was called. And a lot of people had summer homes on the lake. And they had a great big wooden auditorium. And they had the famous Chautauqua programs down at the lake.
And people brought their tents, too.
And people brought their tents, but there were places, there were places to rent. And we used to go to the Chautauqua programs and then go swimming. The lake was very good for swimming, because it was salty by that time. Very little fish life left, whereas in 1880 they took fish out of the lake by the carload. But it was a lovely time in the summer at Chautauqua, swimming at the lake. And we used to either hike it or take the trolley or hitch rides down to the lake from the town.
In a sense, you were at the end of the harvest. Did you ever, in summer, when you got older, work in the harvest or work out on the farm?
Oh, yes. In high school, and then later when I was at the university and was home in the summer, I worked on the farms,
sure.
Worked in the harvest. I never cared for farm work. And it was really too rough. Work was too hard. You started at dawn and worked till sunset, and pitching bundles and shocking and so on in the wheat fields. I lost weight rather than putting weight on, so it wasn't a good training deal for me. It wasn't a good training experience for me. And I never liked it very much. But you met the itinerant farm workers on the farms, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and you saw and became acquainted with the migrant farm workers who started in Texas, and as the harvest progressed, had moved from all the way from Texas up to Dakota.
I went with the crew partway through Nebraska once. Everything you say is right.
Of course, the farms that I worked on, I knew the people, and they knew my family and so on. So from that point of view, it was all right, but I never liked that part of it.
Was that area horse or tractor?
Well, in those days, the 20s, it was horse, and I had plowed days on end with 5-team hitch, two bottoms. You'd drive the 5-team hitch all day long, and you ride the plow, and it gets pretty dull. Funny thing about it, here you were in the center of the American continent, and as you'd plow, you'd be followed by seagulls. Mm-hmm. The earth was turned.
I didn't know that.
The seagulls. Of course, there were lots of seagulls around the Devil's Lake. But the gulls, when you were plowing, the gulls would come and follow you, and the earth was turned. Presumably feed on worms and grubs as they were turned.
Did you work in the winters in high school, janitor, or work around the high school?
No, no.
In other words, you just studied and...
I didn't have to work. I had my own...
Yeah.
I was a town agent. I had the agency for the Curtis Publishing Company, Saturday Evening Post, Country Gentleman, Ladies Home Journal. Once a week, I used to collect these tremendously heavy bundles of Saturday Evening Post, Ladies Home Journal, Country Gentleman, and deliver them to all my customers. And that was a lucrative job, but also you had to work hard at least one day a week.
Yeah, you sure did.
And it was an interesting experience, so I had plenty of pocket money, my own pocket money. My mother was a very sharp, capable woman. Great manager. Dad, of course, is a civil servant, had a small salary, and my wife provided a house. Her salary was very small, and the four growing children in Carolina wasn't any chance of accumulating any kind of money. The four of us were coming along, and Mother, Devil's Lake being the center of the trading area, had a huge hotel there called the Great Northern Hotel. This was in the days before automobiles. The salesmen all traveled by train. They'd come into Devil's Lake, and if they were going east, west, south, or north, they would stop there. And my mother went to the manager of the hotel and leased the space in the lobby. And went to the banker, a local banker, one of the bankers, and borrowed some money. Established what she called the lobby flower shop. There were no flower service in the city. And then the lobby shop had magazines and soft drinks and cigars and cigarettes, candy. And she managed this for a period of about 6-7 years. And made a great success out of it and sold out in 1928. I made enough money to send all four of us to the University of Minnesota. Myself and my brother and two sisters. She sold out before the Depression. She hit it just right. She hit it just right. But she would have the foresight and the ability to borrow money with no collateral and develop this business as a tribute to her brains and energy. So my brother and I, later my sisters, used to work down there, and of course we worked down there, we get paid for it. Mother was a good card player.
You remember?
And she used to play cards with all the salesmen. And of course, she beat them all the time. They all liked it, you see.
Sure. Yeah. Do you remember any particular influence that guided you towards college and in the sense that you were that you were expected to go? You weren't expected to stay at home. You were expected to go to college. That sort of thing.
Yeah, at the time, from my junior and senior year, question of where I was going. It was being talked about and thought about at home. I could have gone to U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Yeah, could have gotten an appointment for the North Dakota congressman. Great many of my older friends, Devil's Lake had attended the University of North Dakota, Grand Forks. A few of the youngsters from Devil's Lake had gone down to the University of Minnesota. Minneapolis, of course, was the home of my father's father and my mother's father. And we had lived a short time in Minneapolis, too. And this was the family home.
Just for the record, what was your mother's maiden name?
My mother's maiden name was Lawson. Her father was a master mason, one of those men who was very skilled and never wanted to work because he was always assigned by the contractors to the difficult job. Was essentially a craftsman artist at his work. Mother's mother died when she was about 10 or 11. Mother had made a home for her father from the time she was a girl in grade school, really. Some of the interesting things about that town, we had a band, Devil's Lake Boy Scout Band. They started, and the first director was a German martinet by the name of Carl Weimer. Carl Weimer was a disciplinarian of the first water. If you joined the band and wanted to learn an instrument, if you missed three practices a year, you were kicked out. Couldn't miss any practices. And he maintained this. And consequently had for that day and time, a very, very excellent boys band. Good marching band. He developed some fine, fine musicians. I never was very good at the music, but I had friends who were very, very good, all because of Weimer's discipline. And Devil's Lake Boy Scout Band was hired by the Great Northern Railroad to play at Glacier Park in the summertime. So we'd always make a great trip to Glacier Park and play at Glacier Park for a couple of weeks and then do concerts at all the little towns between Devil's Lake and the western edge of Montana where Glacier Park was located.
It made the discipline almost pleasant then.
Well, it was great fun to be on those.
Did you say you were in it?
Oh, yes.
What did you play?
I played the baritone until I got some front tooth knocked out. Not playing football, swimming, actually. And then I couldn't play the baritone, so then I played the drums. But never very good at either one. And of course, my mother made me take piano lessons, which I never liked, and I didn't want to practice, you know.
You all go through it.
My brother, pretty good piano player today, and my sisters both played, but I never would take kindly to the discipline of the practice. I wanted to be out playing football or playing basketball or something else. Not that I ever had any musical talent, I don't have, and that was perfectly apparent to me and to everyone else. But you went through the usual learning experiences of that kind, and while you may not have musical talent, you develop some appreciation of what it takes to form a fine band. And you get some appreciation of why the band, students in the band, enjoy it. Take the Purdue band. They have a great spirit and great pride. And the reason they're good is because the students enjoy it. In a small high school, I said there were 40 in my senior class. One of the great advantages of this kind of a high school is that you did everything.
Edited the yearbook.
You were involved in everything that went on because of the numbers. The numbers were so small.
Now, did you go
to school plays, the theater, and school government, and all the committees?
And did you
school do athletics?
Did you do debate too?
Debate, sure. You do the whole thing, you see, even though you're not may not be very good or may not be in love with any particular activity. You were exposed to all of this, and you discovered by the exposure how difficult many of these things are. And you discover that your classmates have different talents and different abilities. Some are good at this, some are good at that, and so on. It helps to give you at least enough knowledge about these various pursuits to appreciate them.
You bet you do. And then sometimes you have some nice memories.
Oh,
I remember walking down High Street in Oxford and suddenly hearing the York High School football yell and turned around and here was the man that was quarterback when I was tackle. Otherwise, I don't know. Might never have known each other.
Yeah.
I went to York High School, York, Nebraska. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I think it's a shame that we're getting such large schools that the kids can't do that. I suppose a lively boy today in a school with 300 or 400 and graduating seniors can do some of it, but he can't do all of it the way you did.
Well, the curriculum available was limited, but it was essentially limited to the very simple basic subjects, English, mathematics, sciences, economics,
Latin.
I took Latin in 7th and 8th grades, not in high school. And this was never very interesting to me. Didn't care much for it. And French and German available in languages in high school. But I found that when I went to the university, we were talking about going to the university and my educational plans. There was a lot of pressure on me to go to the University of North Dakota because I played football in high school. Had a lot of friends down there. But I knew the coach and I knew his reputation. He liked big men, and I was very small. I'd made up my mind I wanted to study engineering. My first choice was civil engineering. And so I went to the University of Minnesota. Because of, we had family in Minneapolis and so on. And I didn't want to go to the University of North Dakota. And in going to the University of Minnesota, I had made up my mind that I would never be able to make the Minnesota teams. I think I could. Although I wanted to.
But Berman coached then, or was that later?
You know, Berman coached after my undergraduate days. I went to the University of Minnesota in the fall of 25. And I thought, my God, the university would be terribly difficult. So at the end of the first quarter, I was like straight A's in all my classes. Discovered that it wasn't very difficult after all. And I wasn't handicapped in any way in the class.
Did you go out for football that fall?
Oh, yes.
Too?
Sure, freshman football. And I was playing on about the 5th freshman team most of the time.
Make the trips?
Well, we didn't have any trips with freshmen.
With freshmen.
We didn't have any games going on. I'm out for freshman basketball, freshman track.
In those days, a man of your height could still play basketball.
Oh, yes, I played. I was on the squad my sophomore year. I didn't get a letter, but I was on the squad, and I played 2 years at guard. I wasn't a very good shot. Our gym in Devil's Lake was a gym with very low ceilings. And we never learned to shoot. Our team was a very good passing team, and we drove for the basket. And although we had nobody that could shoot long shots in those days. But I took freshman chemistry at Minnesota. And Professor Heisig, G.B. Heisig. And I liked the freshman chemistry course. Enjoyed it.
Were you in the College of Arts and Sciences, or was there a College of Engineering?
School of Engineering. We took mathematics and English, and chemistry, physics, and usual freshman curriculum. But I liked chemistry so much, I then transferred and said I didn't want to be a civil engineer, I was going to be a chemical engineer. And I finished out chemical engineering. So
in the same college?
Oh yes, that was the School of Chemical Engineering. And I enjoyed that. My hometown was a Fidel town. There were a lot of older boys who were Fidels of North Dakota. And when I went to the University of Minnesota, I got a Fidel rush as a freshman. And I liked the chapter of pledge. In my pledge class was about 13 men. And those 13 men were seniors. Four of us were in the one house, were members of the two senior honorary societies. We won more varsity letters than any other house. Football and basketball and track. We had two or three Tau Beta Pis from engineering, two or three Phi Betas.
It was a good house.
It was a class of 15 very, very unusual young guys. So we had a lot of fun.
Have you hung together pretty well after graduation?
Oh, we all spread all over, and well, each other. Everybody's paths spread all over the world, and we very rarely run into them. Remember them with affection and fond memories. The good times you had together.
In other words, for you, the fraternity system was pretty good. Did you live in the
house?
Oh,
it gave me a place to live, you see.
You lived in the house.
Rooming house when I first lived there. In the rooming house, I suppose there were 8 or 10 other boys in this house. Several of them became good friends, older boys. But I only stayed in the rooming house 2 quarters and then moved to the Fidel house. I spent the rest of my time there. And that was a very pleasant time of life. It was the decade of the Roaring Twenties.
there were no
jazz,
such things as you
movies
didn't.
Movies and flappers and speakeasies and the golden decade, the stock market.
Of course, the Fidels would never go to a speakeasy, would they?
Oh no, no.
Oh.
But the University of Minnesota itself. It was a fabulous place. I was alive. Things were happening. great intellectual ferment, great intellectual stimulation. It was growing. The state of Minnesota had great pride in the university. It was vital and alive. And there were undercurrents that we've seen later, that we've seen flower later, that were there in my day as a student. Pacifism, for instance. Pacifism manifested itself in student reaction, even in my day, against ROTC.
Did you have to take ROTC?
And so on. It was required. Yeah. Minnesota was the first land-grant university to abandon the requirement of ROTC. I suppose in those days, the decade of the 20s, University of Minnesota and the University of Wisconsin were two of the most vital universities in terms of intellectual impact
Now, did you do anything, did you have any activities besides your normal classes and your athletics that you were in, such as drama or politics?
Well, I was involved through the fraternity in student politics.
Student council?
Well, no, I was a candidate to lead the junior ball. That was an elective office. And I was a member of the senior honoring society called Greyfriars. Greyfriars, there were two senior honoring societies, Iron Wedge and Greyfriars in my day. And each of these groups had all the student leaders. The Greyfriars were running the whole show. We beat the Iron Wedge at everything we set out to do, including winning all the elections. And Greyfriars was the oldest of the fraternity. We were heavily involved in running all the politics and controlling all the student activities at the university. And I was a candidate for the presidency of the junior ball, which was the biggest party of the year, in the days when the junior ball was something. Red Stassen was our political leader, great class, my class. And he was quite an individual. He had the makings of a master politician. In those days, and later became one of the youngest governors Minnesota ever had, and a very good governor. He kind of lost his head when he wanted to be president of the United States and took on Dewey after World War II.
I remember
Dewey
those days.
Slaughtered him. But,
See, Stassen was on the rifle team, too.
I didn't shoot. Stassen was a champion.
Yep.
He won the national, I don't know whether he won the national championship or not, but he was on the Minnesota rifle team, I know. Stassen was in law school and was a Pullman porter. He used to take a couple of runs a week on a Pullman run and then go to law school. But it's off the university that way. Came from South St. Paul. A big red-headed kid, smart, great debater.
Did he play football great too team. With you?
No, he wasn't a football player. I had no interest in student dramatics and student debate. So I'm between my athletics and university studies, fraternity.
You were kept busy.
I was kept busy. It was a problem budgeting your time from morning to night. Get out for football in the fall at 4:30. I had to do my lab work twice as fast as anybody else. To leave the laboratory. Laboratories went on to 5:30. I used to leave about 4:15. I had to do all my work before I left. So you budgeted your time and worked at top speed.
In other words, you learned to concentrate.
Well, sure, but more than that, you learned to concentrate in the classroom. I always figured that you had to spend an hour in the classroom, you might as well utilize the hour. So, if you utilized the hour in the classroom, it meant you didn't have to spend that much time outside the class. That was a problem of concentrating in the classroom hours, getting your work done that way.
You mean you didn't demand that the professor be interesting or charming?
No, you see, this is one of the great mistakes that people make about teachers. People are fascinating, to be sure. The world is composed of people. And there are many, many different kinds, as you know. But the nature of what you're studying is the interesting thing, and that's almost independent of people. You're studying calculus. You can study calculus in every university in America, completely independent of who happens to be teaching calculus.
Sure.
Now, the particular individual may make it more or less fun. The reason you're in there is because you want to learn calculus, not because you want to become acquainted with Professor Jones, or you want to watch Professor Jones perform. Well, you may be amused by his performances, and he may be a man of tremendous intuitive skill and so on to stimulate you and interest you and to get you over the rough spots and explain what the hell calculus is all about and give you the path to the insight that it takes. But to me, we're never so much the person teaching. Was what was being taught.
And the fun of discovering it.
Well, that too, but it's always nice to, always a thrill of those of learning. The world is such a wondrous place and filled with so many wondrous things that your only regret is that your life is too short. You can't possibly know enough about all the interesting things in this fabulous nature of ours, the natural world and its people. Say nothing of the cosmic world. Beyond our ken, beyond our environment. Of course,
what did you do for
kid?
Excuse me.
Saw the stars and the aurora borealis and the northern lights, which were brilliant at times up as far north as the pole. Dad explaining the stars and the universe and the concept of light years, how far away they were, the immensity of space and the inability of the human mind to really grasp this fact. Because the mind is not really capable of understanding the immensity of space. Go out as far as you can think of, and then you can go out that far again, and then that far again.
And then you haven't even started.
And then you haven't gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
I never figured I had a bad teacher. Some were less capable than others, and some were less interested than others, and some were less interested in me than others. All these things add up to the human relationship that's involved in the teacher-pupil confrontation, working together. But to me, the subject matter was always the important thing. And actually, in retrospect, the teachers that you appreciate after you finish are those that are the hardest taskmasters. Strange. Now, there were some teachers that you liked as people and became friends. But that was, again, that was another relationship that was independent of the subject matter they happened to teach. You would have been friends with them whether they taught Latin or calculus. It didn't make any difference. But you liked them as individuals. I had a great many friends on the faculty at the university. One of the men, one of the poorest teachers I ever had, is a friend of mine to this day. Taught descriptive geometry, which I happened to take in summer session, that summer session. Descriptive geometry is a difficult course, unless you have the talent to see three dimensions condensed into two and represented by lines. It requires the ability to handle spatial configurations and the relationships. This teacher was very poor in explaining the problems and what we were trying to accomplish. He'd give his presentation, then leave, and we were all in a room with big tables. You sat at to do your plates. It just so happened that this was like eating pie to me. I mean, I could do my plates about as fast as I could put them down. Then I'd do my plate, and then I'd teach the class. All my friends were there. So the instructor would leave us, you see. And the problem of taking up where he left off and explaining to these kids what was supposed to be done in a problem in descriptive geometry, in the plate that you had to produce, the representation of a three-dimensional model in a flat plane by projections. It was hard for a lot of these kids to do and to see in their mind's eye. But I liked the man as a man. He had a hell of a job explaining to those kids. He didn't have to explain it to me. I mean, I could tell right from the start what was wanted and what the object of the game was, so to speak. But all the rest of the kids always complained bitterly about this man because they couldn't understand. Couldn't put it across. But this wasn't operative with me because I understood it, even though I was being introduced to it for the first time too. But there were people who taught that you didn't, the chemistry of human like human likes and dislikes is a strange kind of chemistry. There are people that you say to yourself, well, I don't like that person, not quite that strong, you have no interest. And there are other people which you're very interested in. Why that occurs, I don't know. Lots of the teachers you have no personal interest in them as people, particularly. Others you develop great admiration for, friendship, appreciation. The human chemistry is there. And this is why many teachers can't ring the bell with 100% of their students, and no teacher ever does. If you can ring the bell with 50% of your students, you're doing very well, in my opinion.
And kindle a little fire so that they'll...
Well, I say, if you're doing 50% of your kids, you're pretty good.
Yeah.
But I don't pretend to understand this human chemistry. You know it's there, and you see it function in many different ways. You see its results, you see the relationships that develop between people. Indifference, like, dislike.
When you were an undergraduate, did you develop any aesthetic interest in the sense of the concerts that Minnesota had and a wonderful concert hall? It's one of the best in any university I've ever seen. It's a beautiful hall.
When I was a student, Northrop Auditorium was being built.
It wasn't there then.
Well, it was being built.
It was just being built.
It was being built. And of course, later on when I was on the faculty there, I went to many things at Northrop Auditorium. And I went to a good many of the things. Always liked the symphonies and the music and the artists and all the rest of it. It's like you always appreciate excellent performance and the performance of the top flight people, and you realize that they're top flight because they're good.
And the I take it you went to the Sheridan movies and the theater downtown.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the one thing you have
to go to the Orpheum on Sundays, see the old vaudeville, days.
Something went out of American life when vaudeville went, didn't it?
Yeah, of course, the modern vaudeville is TV.
Right.
And you still see vaudeville acts on TV, or what would be vaudeville acts then. See, the Ed Sullivan Show was really a vaudeville show.
That's all it was.
For many years. He had everything, including acrobats and jugglers and magicians. Including that. But New York, you know, well, good stuff. And at the other end of the scale was the Gaiety with Carrie Fennell.
A burlesque.
The famous burlesque queen.
In my day, we went to the Old Howard to see Ann Corio.
Well, Ann Corio was a famous name among the burlesque queens.
Correct.
But my student days in the 20s at the Gaiety on Washington Avenue was Carrie Fennell.
Then they had the pit bands, too, in those days.
There were a great many student bands, too.
Yeah.
Orchestras. It was the beginning of jazz, modern jazz. I used to play in an orchestra, a little five-piece orchestra. Played with country dances around Bell's Lake. Kind of
Saturday nights, you pick up sometimes $5.
Oh, yeah. I played the trap drums and the piano player and trumpet player and trombone player and sax player. All kids from the band. And in those days, I knew all the popular music. It was popular in the 20s.
I take it you must have, at Minnesota, must have called on the sororities a little. Was the Kappa House popular in your day?
Well, in my day, the Kappas were probably one of the two or three best all-around sororities in terms of their membership and their leadership and their girls.
Of course, I'm leading up to the fact that you meet Mrs. Hubney there.
Well, first date I ever had at the University of Minnesota was engineered by one of my friends in my rooming house. He was going with a Kappa. I got a date with another little freshman Kappa girl. But that just was a happenstance. But I... The Fidel House was one door from the Alpha Gamma House and two doors from the Pi Phi House and a block from Sorority Row. So we saw a great many of the girls. Girls in many of the houses. So I never was particularly interested in girls. That time. I had too much to do, and dates were few and far between, actually. But I met Mrs. Hubney through one of my roommates at the Fidel House, traveling to Sam Rogers. Phi Beta Kappa Junior Year, 3 days of Minnesota, one of the smartest young men you ever met. He spent his career in banking in Minneapolis. My senior year, we were final football game was at Wisconsin. The Wednesday after that Saturday, there was a famous fraternity party called the Phi Cap Bali Party. Invitations were sent by the Phi Caps to two people from each of the other fraternities. And it was kind of a famous party that everybody liked to get an invitation to go to. And that week before the Wisconsin game, I'd asked a girl to go with me and something could, she was being gone or something really happened. So I said to Sam, get me a date for the Phi Cap Bowery party. He and his girl were going. And his girl and the way they married was a Minneapolis girl. She said, well, how about Priscilla Boyd? Chris had come back that fall from UCLA. She went 2 years to UCLA, was a Catholic UCLA. And her father had retired and gone to California and lost his money in California. Went, moved back to Minneapolis and started work again, all over. And he brought his daughter back. He said, if you're going to UCLA out in California, you might as well go to the University of Minnesota. That's just as good. She didn't like this. She wanted to stay at UCLA. That was in the days before UCLA was moving to the new campus. She was staying with her grandmother out there. Los Angeles was quite a place in the 20s.
It certainly was.
And she was having a great time. But she came back that fall. She didn't like the University of Minnesota. She was missing all her friends and life in California. She'd gone to LA High School and lots of her girlfriends and boyfriends out there. So we met that night for the Phi Cap Bowery party. We struck it off very well. I liked her and vice versa. Then that December, after football season, I got the Red Scholarship. I knew I would be gone for 2 or 3 years. But we had a great time our senior year. And it was her junior year. Lots of those girls. Five-fives and Rumpelgans and Tri-Delts and Thetas, Kappas and Gamma-fives, and a whole block of them. Met them through the other boys.
And classes too.
Pleasant social life. Okay. And half the fraternity lived in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Used to visit their homes and for meals and so on. So that part of it was fun.
What do you look back on as the most pleasant time? Now, what did you do that you enjoyed most? I'd almost bet it that you enjoyed your athletics and football as much
well, see,
outside of class.
The athletic part of it was, it doesn't really matter a damn to anybody whether I played football or not. It only means something to me.
That's right.
Thousands of people watch me play. People still, I meet people still who recall games and they saw me play and all that sort of thing. But the real answer is a personal one. It relates to your own ego. When I was a freshman, as I say, I was about the fifth freshman team. Finally got a numeral by playing well in one of the inter-squad games. I was getting my teeth. My sophomore year, I was on the squad. I got into 5 or 6 games for a few minutes. My junior year, Shorty Youngquist was playing left halfback and quarterback for the first 2 or 3 games. Things weren't going well. The coach started me in the Iowa game, and we won the game 37-0. And everything I did was perfect, and then I was in, you see. But the ego involvement that all of us have with ourselves, the fact that I weighed 150 pounds, and that I could make the team, make a Big Ten team, and against the competition was an enormous inner satisfaction.
Certainly.
Enormous inner satisfaction. And I know that it's only one meaningful to me. Doesn't make a damn bit of difference in the life of anybody else.
One of the funniest stories I ever heard you tell to the banquet was the story of Bronco Nagurski saying to you, "I'll open the hole, you just follow me right through."
Well, Bronk was a teammate and was a very interesting man.
He was a team player too, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, great team player, great football player. Super, I mean, best of his time, unquestionably. In terms of physical ability and spirit and fire and sheer strength and speed, the ability to play the game. The Bronk was an interesting individual. And of course, it was fine for me to play with him. I often said, anybody could carry the ball with Bronco running interference for you. But I was fast. I mean, I could run fast in those days. But I knew more. I knew what every player did on every play. I knew where all the plays and all the things that could happen in the defense and so on. And it was an intellectual challenge to me, the football.
Again, it was a solving a problem.
It was a solving a problem. It was a tactical problem on the field, strategic problem. How to maximize your forces at your command, and how to stop the other guy. And,
you think it's changed a great deal in fundamentals?
The fundamentals don't change, but the training methods, the teaching methods, the coaching methods, the regimen, the films, the analysis, a great many minds have been put on football, just like other things. Take the professionals. I mean, every little tiny facet of the game is studied from A to Z. And in that sense, there's been an awful lot of analysis put on the game of football since the days I played. And it's changed a great deal. The athletes are bigger and stronger and better. They have better high school coaching. Changed primarily with the increase in skills and forward passing and catching in my day.
Did you play Notre Dame in those days?
Yes.
Then you must have had a little shot at the Four Horsemen.
No.
No, they came
just
after
before.
You.
They were before. Four Horsemen around 1924.
Did you have a shot at Red Grange?
He was just before me, too. He was about the same time.
Yeah.
I played in 1927, 1928, junior and senior years. And that was before the, after the Four Horsemen. But we played Notre Dame in 1927. In the last game on Cartier Field, before they built the present Notre Dame Stadium. And we tied them there that day in a day of, we tied them 7-7. And it was a terrible day, sleet storm, cold, raining, sleet, muddy field. We had a very, we had an undefeated team in 1927. And a couple of Notre Dame tie.
You know, I
tied
remember
Indiana.
I remember in high school
going
in
there, but
you know, I remember in high school in those days. Of course, we were all playing. Those who want to play football, playing the University of Nebraska, and it was always the, if you can beat Minnesota, you're a good team. Regardless of what happened in the Big Eight, Nebraska was always pointing for you, and as I remember,
it was an early game for Minnesota, and those years Minnesota almost always beat Nebraska.
Always.
Yeah.
They came back, they'd be, you know, next year, all right.
Nebraska was one of the non-conference opponents.
Yeah. But your big opponent always was Wisconsin, wasn't it, or was it Michigan?
Well, we had three natural rivals, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Michigan. Wisconsin was always the last game of the season. Michigan was always a traditional rival that Minnesota found difficult to beat. Although in 1927 I played in Ann Arbor and we beat Michigan. Benny Osterbaden was playing. And Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
And we beat them 13-7.
How was Purdue in those days?
Well, Purdue was good in 1928. And won the championship in 1929. That was failing the championship. They were supposed to win the championship in 1928. We beat them 15-0 at Purdue, at Minnesota. And after the game, I had the game ball at home. I was given the game ball. And then later I became president of Purdue. But we beat Harmison and Welch and that crew. 15-0. And the next year they won the conference championship. But I, it was one of those little coincidences that happened the ball was given to me after that first Big Ten game. And I should later become president of Purdue.
That's interesting. You, of course, have never reminded any of the gentlemen of the, that you got.
Well, Red was playing on the Purdue team.
You knew Red then. Quite obviously.
Well, I didn't know, but I really knew Red till I came here.
Yeah.
He was playing ends for Purdue.
I think in his interview he said that he had played against you.
Yeah. I scored the first touchdown of the game on a 50-yard run. It was a short pass to me. And I ran 50 yards for a touchdown. I retrieved past Welch and Glenn Hamilton. I was going between them when they were standing there. Sucking their thumbs. It was one of those situations where, you know, it happens once in a while. You call the right play at the right time, just catches them flat-footed. The last thing in the world they would have expected.
Yeah, it happens. Mm-hmm. Well, as you look back on it, Minnesota, as you said, was alive, so was Wisconsin in those days. Did you get any honors at that time? And you said the Rhodes Scholarship. I'd like to have you go into that. How did you get, I mean, I know how you got it.
Well, the other honors that you got, of course, the academic
honors. That's what I meant.
Tau Beta Pi and Phi Lambda Upsilon. The chemical fraternity. Well, it's quite unjust, it's a gem.
election to those was a, again, a deep satisfaction, ego satisfaction.
To distinguish yourself both academically and in the athletic world is unusual, and it is a satisfaction, I know. Were you, now, someone told me that while you were at Minnesota as an undergraduate, you became friend of the president of the university.
Oh, well, President Lotus Delta Kaufman was president.
Correct.
I always had a great admiration for him, but my acquaintance with Lotus Delta Kaufman and my admiration for him really grew when I went back
from
the staff and was in the General College with Malcolm McLean. Then I was a member of the administrative staff of the university. And I got my first baptism of what university administration is all about, what its ingredients and problems were, and developed a tremendous admiration for Kaufman. Well, I always thought.
Well, the reason I'm asking, I didn't know where this came.
The state university president that I've known.
I had understood that he had known you as an undergraduate, and
well, he may have known me because I played football,
yeah,
and so on, but I wasn't personally acquainted with him. I had no opportunity to do so.
Well, that's what. How did when you went to Rhodes? How come you went to Brasenose? Did they select you, or did you select Brasenose?
Well, this was fortuitous. Happenstance. The end of November, football season had just ended. My senior year, I began to think about the college year, what I was going to do. And I went for a job, spring of 29. I kind of thought I might like a job in industry, in chemical engineer. I read the Exponent, student newspaper. I had an announcement that candidates interested in the Rhodes Scholarship can see so-and-so and have their applications in. And I thought, it also said that in those days, you could apply from the state where your university was located, or your home state for your family there, because the scholarships were awarded by states. And I looked through the list of eligible states, and Minnesota was, that was an off year. But it was an on year for North Dakota. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'm going to apply for it. I'm going to England and study physical chemistry. So I rapidly got together my papers and wrote my essay. And so everybody whose name I put down, the references and so on. And then in early December, I got word to go to the selection committee meeting at Grand Forks, University of North Dakota. Well, this was fine because I could go to that meeting and then go on home until I was late, but my family was still living. So I went up to the meeting, and on the committee were two men, one from St. Paul, one from Minneapolis, ex-Rhodes Scholars. They were older men who'd been in the early groups of Rhodes Scholars.
Before World War I, probably.
Yeah, yeah, they were both there before World War I. And the president of the University of North Dakota. Well, the president of the University of North Dakota didn't like me worth sour apples because I didn't go to the University of North Dakota in the first place. I was a renegade and got a flight in. And second, no applicant from the University of North Dakota had ever won a Rhodes Scholarship. All the Rhodes Scholars from North Dakota were kids who'd gone to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Minnesota, or someplace else. And the president
His name was King. I remember him to this day. He had written to the secretary, American secretary. I learned this later, attesting the fact that committees had always chosen students from other universities rather than University of North Dakota, Grand Forks. Well, I suppose there were 15 candidates. Very likable, interesting guys, of course.
Sure.
And I was interviewed, had my interview, and they told me to wait around. And I went back a second time. And I saw the rest of it, and I went back a third time. And finally, late that afternoon, finally dismissed us. It was obvious from all my interviews that President King was against me. I could just feel it. So a friend of mine was there with his car to pick me up to drive on to Devil's Lake, 100 miles over gravel roads. They were having a big dinner for me at home. And we pulled into this dinner about 8 o'clock that night, and here were 200 or 300 people gathered in a big hotel at a dinner for me, where they gave me a $500 gift and a watch. And that sort of thing. Then I got the Sunday night train back to Minneapolis early morning, and I got the streetcar out to the university. I got the streetcar to University of 10th Avenue, 11th Avenue. I walked the block down to the private house. So I started down the walk towards the house when the boys came out of the house, going up to school, and saw me coming and yelled at me, "Congratulations." I said, "What for?" He said, "The announcement of you're winning the Rhodes Scholarship's in the morning paper." That's the first I knew of it. And these two men from St. Paul and Minneapolis had
taken care of
rule.
Sure.
Well, they and elected me. So that next week, I went down to see this man in Minneapolis. He was a banker in Minneapolis, a very wonderful guy. And he said, "You have to fill out this form," which goes to the Oxford secretary, Sir Francis Wiley, "listing the colleges in order of your choice." Well, I said, "This man, faintest idea about Oxford colleges." Well, he said, "From my memory," he said, "doesn't matter very much which one you go to," but he said, "Magdalen's a good college, New College is a good college, University's a good college, Christ Church's a good college, Baylor's a good college." He wrote these down, and I think the 10th on the list is Brasenell, so there are 10 places. I think Baylor was first, Magdalen second, and New College third. I don't know how he listed them. It was his own list, you see, yeah, from his memory. Well, finally received word that I was to be a member of Brasenell's college. Well, I didn't even remember where I put Brasenell's.
Now, for the clerk typist who's listening to this, I think we ought to spell Brasenell's.
B-R-A-S-E-N-O-S-E, Brasenell's.
Because of the knocker on the front gate, as I remember.
Real name is the King's Hall and College of Brasenell's.
Did you...
I learned later that Sir Francis Wiley, who was Oxford secretary, that unless you put the college that you want first, the college isn't interested in you. I mean, they're not interested in... Brasenell's wasn't interested in me when I put Brasenell's 10th.
No.
Of course not. Even though they might vaguely know that we didn't know much about colleges. I learned later that Sir Francis Wiley, who happened to be a fellow of Brasenell's, that I didn't make the colleges on my first choice. The Harvard boys and the Princeton boys generally get Baylor.
It's because they don't know any better.
They don't know any better, you see, over there.
But, sir, I wasn't in a college after they'd all looked at the dossiers, and Sir Francis Wiley, I'm told, went around to the principal of Brasenose and said, take this kid from Minnesota. There were three of us in the Free Road Scholars in Brasenose in my class. One was Malcolm McIntyre, a Yale Road Scholar. The other was Armistead Booth, a University of Virginia Road Scholar. And myself. And it happened to be a very, very good choice for me because Brasenose is the Hardy College. Great athletic tradition.
You were right at home.
The principal, Saunders, who himself wasn't an athlete, but was interested in all the men in college that played the games.
Did you ever, the soccer players, the rowers, the crewmen, the cricket players. Did you ever know well the crew coach at Brasenose, William Holdsworth?
Oh, sure. Sir William Holdsworth, the great law tutor?
I have been trying to have the Purdue University Library since 1948 get a complete set of his great books. We finally, maybe, be able to get a set.
Well, the father was a famous tutor and writer in law.
Well, this is the...
His son was in Brasenose.
I wasn't aware of that. The father is one of the great...
There's a Holdsworth in school in Brasenose in my time.
Well, the father, of course, is the great historian of English law.
Yeah.
Nobody can touch him. No one's ever been able to touch him.
Yeah. Well, he wrote volume after volume after volume.
That's right, and that's what I've been trying to get for Purdue University for years.
Yeah.
I think we're going to finally make it, too, before I get out.
Well, I think we've had enough for today. We can start.
All right. Now, we'll say that this is the end of tape one, May 16th. This is Professor Eccles of the Department of History talking with President Emeritus of Purdue University, F.L. Hutton.